I am Neo. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena. Today is December 5th, 2010. The website is theskepticarena.com. Today's topic, an article by Melanie Mason entitled GOP Congressional Candidate Stephen Brodin Says Violent Overthrow of Government is on the Table. The article begins, Republican congressional candidate Stephen Brodin stunned his party, saying he would not rule out violent overthrow of the government if elections did not produce a change in leadership. Well, Stephen, that certainly is awfully American of you. So if you believe you are justified in using violence to ensure your party's control of government, then how could you argue against the other party having that same right? So your idea of government is that the losing side has the right to violence to gain the power it could not achieve through the democratic process? Okay, I'll buy that. That seems reasonable enough to me. The article continues. In a rambling exchange during a TV interview, Brodin, a South Dallas pastor, said a violent uprising is not the first option, but it is on the table. My comment. A pastor. Now everything is coming into focus. He preaches, "Thou shalt not kill" on Sundays, and then grabs his shotgun on Mondays. So typical. The article goes on. That drew a quick denunciation from the head of the Dallas County GOP, who called the remarks inappropriate. My comment. Talk about an understatement. I would say remarks like that are a little more than inappropriate. Continuing, Brodin, a first-time candidate, is challenging veteran incumbent Eddie Bernice Johnson in Dallas's heavily Democratic 30th Congressional District. Johnson's campaign declined to comment on Brodin. In the interview, Brad Watson, political reporter for WFAA-TV, Channel 8, asked Brodin about a Tea Party event last year in Fort Worth in which he described the nation's government as tyrannical. Brodin said, "We have a constitutional remedy, and the framers say, if that don't work, revolution." Stephen, they said if it doesn't work, not if it don't work. Continuing, Watson asked if his definition of revolution included violent overthrow of the government. In a prolonged back and forth, Brodin at first declined to explicitly address insurrection, saying the first way to deal with a repressive government is to alter it or abolish it. He said, "If the government is not producing the results or has become destructive to the ends of our liberties, we have a right to get rid of that government and to get rid of it by any means necessary." Stephen, who decides if it's not producing the results? How has it become destructive to the ends of our liberties? The answer to the first question is the people, through the democratic process. The answer to the second question is it hasn't. Our liberties are protected by a division of power among the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government. Brodin said, adding that the nation was founded on a violent revolt against Britain's King George III. Stephen, our nation was founded on violent revolt. Many Americans owned slaves. Many Christians burned innocent women at the stake for being witches. Land was taken from indigenous people too weak to defend it. There is a long list of things that our history has condoned, things that modern Americans rationalize away by claiming the ends justify the means. But nothing makes it right. The article continues. Watson asked if violence would be an option in 2010 under the current government. He said the option is on the table. I don't think we should remove anything from the table as it relates to our liberties and our freedoms. Stephen, how about the option of not being killed by insane morons like you? Is that an option for the rest of us? The article goes on. Brodin said, without elaborating, However, it is not the first option. Jonathan Neerman, head of the Dallas County Republican Party, said he's never heard Broden or other local Republican candidates advocate violence against the government. He said, "It's disappointing, an isolated incident." He said he plans to discuss the matter with Broden's campaign. Ken Emanuelson, a Broden supporter and leading Tea Party organizer in Dallas, said he did not disagree with the philosophical point that people had the right to resist a tyrannical government. But he said, "Do I see our government today anywhere close to that point? No, I don't." So, Ken, when you decide that you think our government is close to that point, then what? You load up old Betsy and start shooting kids in the street? You bomb a mosque? What exactly do you foresee doing when you decide that point has been reached? Emanuelson said he's occasionally heard people call for direct action against the government, but that they typically do not get involved in electoral politics. Ken, based on the percentage of votes Stephen got, 22%, I would say that he didn't get involved in electoral politics either. Well, at least he still has the pastor gig going, right? Right, Ken? Don't tell me he gave that up. At least tell me he still tends to his flock. The article goes on, that Broden is engaged in the election and running for office shows he's got faith in the system as it is, Emanuelson said. Ken, so now that Stephen got his ass kicked worse than any candidate in history, are you guys going to start cleaning your shotguns? The article goes on, also in the interview, Broden backed away from other controversial statements he has made at rallies and on cable news appearances. In June 2009, he described the economic crash in the housing, banking, and automotive industries as contrived and a setup by the Obama administration. My comment, and as a pastor, how would he know that? Is he trained in economics? Does he have government experience? That can't be, because earlier you said this was his first race. So where did Stephen come by all this knowledge about subjects outside his area of expertise? It continues. Asked Thursday about the validity of these, Broden said they were authentic crises facing this nation. Stephen, why weren't these crises a problem when they were created under the Bush administration? It continues, Broden also retreated from other remarks last year that chided Americans for not being more outraged over government intrusion, comparing them to Jews walking into the furnaces under the Nazi regime in Germany. Stephen, if you were a Jew being marched into a furnace, what would you have done? Threaten the Nazis with a lawsuit? Call them nasty names? What makes you think you could have done any more than they did? The article continues. Broden said of the government leaders, "They are our enemies, and we must resist them." Broden said Thursday that he wasn't trying to compare President Barack Obama to Hitler, and he mistakenly linked the U.S. in 2010 to Nazi Germany. In the uphill campaign against Johnson, Broden has sought to capitalize on her misuse of scholarship funds from the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, a nonprofit entity. In late August, the Dallas Morning News reported that Johnson provided 23 scholarships over 5 years to two of her grandsons, two children of her nephew, and two children of her top aide in Dallas. None of those recipients were eligible under the foundation's anti-nepotism rules or residency requirements. She has repaid the foundation more than $31,000. My final comment. Doesn't sound like voters were given much of a choice. A crook or a kook? Talk about a lose-lose. And now we move to the science segment. Today's story. A cure for the common cold may finally be achieved as a result of a remarkable discovery in a Cambridge laboratory. In a dramatic breakthrough that could affect millions of lives, scientists have been able to show for the first time that the body's immune defenses can destroy the common cold virus after it has actually invaded the inner sanctum of a human cell, a feat that was believed until now to be impossible. The discovery opens the door to the development of a new class of antiviral drugs that work by enhancing this natural virus-killing machinery of the cell. Scientists believe the first clinical trials of new drugs based on the findings could begin within 2 to 5 years. The researchers said that many other viruses responsible for a range of diseases could also be targeted by the new approach. Viruses are still mankind's biggest killers, responsible for twice as many deaths as cancer, essentially because they can get inside cells where they can hide away from the body's immune defenses, and the powerful antibiotic drugs that have proved invaluable against bacterial infections. However, a study by a team of researchers from the world-famous Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge has shown that this textbook explanation of the limits of the human immune system is wrong, because antiviral antibodies can in fact enter the cell with the invading virus where they are able to trigger the rapid destruction of the foreign invader. Leo James said, "In any immunity textbook, you will read that once a virus makes it into a cell, that it is game over because the cell is now infected. At that point, there is nothing the immune response system can do other than kill that cell." But studies at the Medical Research Council's laboratory have found that the antibodies produced by the immune system, which recognize and attack invading viruses, actually ride piggyback into the inside of a cell with the invading virus. Once inside the cell, the presence of the antibody is recognized by a naturally occurring protein in the cell called TRIM21, which in turn activates a powerful virus-crushing machinery that can eliminate the virus within 2 hours, long before it has the chance to hijack the cell to start making its own viral proteins. Dr. James said this is the last opportunity a cell gets, because after that it gets infected, and there is nothing else the body can do but kill the cell. The antibody is attached to the virus, and when the virus gets sucked inside the cell, the antibody stays attached. There is nothing in that process to make the antibody to fall off. The great thing about it is that there shouldn't be anything attached to antibodies in the cell, so that anything that is attached to the antibody is recognized as foreign and destroyed. In the past, it was thought that the antibodies of the immune system worked entirely outside the cells, in the blood, and other extracellular fluids of the body. Now scientists realize that there is another layer of defense inside the cells where it might be possible to enhance the natural antivirus machinery of the body. Dr. James said the beauty of it is that for every infection event, for every time a virus enters a cell, it is also an opportunity for the antibody in the cells to take the virus out. That is the key concept that is different from how we think about immunity. At the moment, we think of professional immune cells such as T cells, which are white blood cells, that patrol the body, and if they find anything, they kill it. This system is more like an ambush because the virus has to go into the cell at some point, and every time they do this, this immune mechanism has a chance of taking it out. It's certainly a very fast process. We've shown that once it enters the cell, it gets degraded within an hour or 2 hours. That's very fast. The study, published in the Journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, involved human cells cultured in the laboratory and will need to be replicated by further research on animals before the first clinical trials with humans. One possibility is that the protein TRIM21 could be used in a nasal spray to combat the many types of viruses that cause the common cold. The kind of viruses that are susceptible to this are the rhinoviruses, which cause the common cold, norovirus, which causes winter vomiting, rotavirus, which cause gastroenteritis. In this country, these are the kinds of viruses that people are most likely to be exposed to. Dr. James added, "This is a way of boosting all the antibodies you'd be naturally making against the virus. The advantage is that you can use that one drug against potentially lots of viral infections. We can think of administering these drugs as nasal sprays and inhalers rather than taking pills. It could lead to an effective treatment for the common cold. The beauty of this system is that you give the virus no chance to make its own proteins to fight back. It is a way for the cell to get rid of the virus and stay alive itself." Sir Greg Winter, deputy director of the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology, said antibodies are formidable molecular war machines. It now appears that they can continue to attack viruses within cells. This research is not only a leap in our understanding of how and where antibodies work, but more generally in our understanding of immunity and infection. And here are the steps how the virus is tackled. First, virus circulating in the bloodstream is recognized by antibodies of the immune system. Next, virus attaches to outer cell membrane with antibodies still attached. 3, virus invades the cell membrane. 4, remains of cell membrane disappear and the virus is free to hijack the cell. 5, TRIM21 protein recognizes attached antibodies as foreign material. 6, powerful virus-destroying machines are attracted to the virus by TRIM21. And finally, virus rapidly broken down and disabled within hours. And now the arena goes abroad. Today we go back to a familiar place, Afghanistan, where the Taliban is turning to child soldiers. The article begins, from 3 and 4 year olds used as human shields or to gather spent cartridges, to teenagers offered motorcycles for planting roadside bombs, children are being used more and more to fight Americans. Lieutenant Colonel Michael Manning says, "We've seen children actually dropping mortar rounds in the firing tubes against us. I've never seen a culture that cares so little for human life. The Taliban truly don't care unless it impacts their own personal family." Brigadier General Joseph Osterman, commander of all Marine ground combat forces, says the use of children on a battlefield has been spreading across Helmand, where Marines began an offensive to drive out the Taliban early this year. Marines have witnessed youngsters dragging away wounded Taliban, planting roadside bombs, and collecting dropped weapons. At a remote fire base east of here, a squad leader, Sergeant John Ellis, says he found children selling heroin doses wrapped in torn pages of the Quran in the village streets. "We also found children with pockets of heroin and wads of cash." A Marine Corps battlefield report describes a fight in the Marjah district in August, where retreating insurgents placed 5 children shoulder to shoulder on the roadway to cover their movements. Once the children were placed, the Taliban element mounted their motorcycles and escaped. Another section of the report describes how a child was sent out onto a roadway to observe a Marine patrol from a distance of 150 yards using hand signals to communicate patrol movements to an adult nearby. Later, the patrol was ambushed. In both instances, the Taliban elements were willing to place children in direct danger to avoid risking themselves. Marine commanders believe that families are either coerced into allowing children to be used by Taliban fighters or, in the case of adolescents, paid money or offered inducements to fight, such as small Chinese-made motorcycles. Manning says, "It's a recruitable, very easily influenced group of people, and there's tons of them." Osterman compares the trend with what happened in areas of Africa, where child soldiers became veteran fighters. Have the Taliban gotten to that point of desperation now where they're going down that road which turns kids into combatants? Marine officials say it is difficult to identify in how many instances insurgents have been using children in Helmand. But they say there have been 50 battlefield reports filed since March listing one or often several cases of kids used in combat. My comment. Men who recruit children to fight are subhumans. In this case, the ideology behind it is religion. However, evil men have done the same thing for reasons other than religion. This disgusting activity, whether motivated by religion or justified on other grounds, is just pure evil. And now for the final segment of the show, famous quotes. Today, Thomas Jefferson. Born 1743, died 1826 at the age of 83. He was the 3rd President of the United States from 1801 to 1809, and the principal author of the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson was one of the most influential founding fathers, known for his promotion of the ideals of republicanism in the United States. Jefferson envisioned America as the force behind a great empire of liberty that would promote republicanism and counter the imperialism of the British Empire. Major events during his presidency include the Louisiana Purchase, the Lewis and Clark Expedition, as well as escalating tensions with both Britain and France that led to the war with Britain in 1812 after he left office. As a political philosopher, Jefferson was a man of the Enlightenment and knew many intellectual leaders in Britain and France. He idealized the independent yeoman farmer as the exemplar of republican virtues, distrusted cities and financiers, and favored states' rights and a strictly limited federal government. Jefferson supported the separation of church and state and was the author of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. He was the co-founder and leader of the Democratic Republican Party, which dominated American politics for 25 years. Prior to his presidency, Jefferson served as the wartime governor of Virginia from 1779 to 1781, the first United States Secretary of State from 1789 to 1793 under Washington, and the second Vice President of the United States from 1797 until 1801 under John Adams. A polymath, Jefferson achieved distinction as a horticulturist, political leader, architect, archaeologist, paleontologist, musician, inventor, and founder of the University of Virginia. When President John F. Kennedy welcomed 49 Nobel Prize winners to the White House in 1962, he said, "I think this is the most extraordinary collection of talent and of human knowledge that has ever been gathered together at the White House, with the possible exception of when Thomas Jefferson dined alone." To date, Jefferson is the only president to serve two full terms in office without vetoing a single bill of Congress. Jefferson has been consistently ranked by scholars as one of the greatest of U.S. presidents. I have many quotes from Thomas Jefferson, so I have decided to break them up into groups of three over the next 3 weeks. So in the next couple of weeks, I will not reread Jefferson's history, but I will just give his quotes. And now for the first three quotes from Thomas Jefferson. The first quote: "It does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg." His second quote: "I am satisfied and sufficiently occupied with the things which are, without tormenting or troubling myself about those which may indeed be, but of which I have no evidence." And the final quote from Thomas Jefferson: "Millions of innocent men, women, and children since the introduction of Christianity have been burnt, tortured, fined, and imprisoned, yet we have not advanced one inch towards uniformity."
Are you ready, Goose? Start walking.